population health as a concept,
yeah,
right, the name,
right,
the actual term, I keep telling people, and I'm getting louder and louder about this when I'm in gatherings of social workers and case managers and everybody, is that this is the greatest gift ever to be given to social work in the last 10 years.
And welcome back to Pop Health Podcast. We hope you had a wonderful 4th of July and are enjoying the summer with family and friends. This week, we feature a very special conversation with Scott Ferguson, the Director of Social Work for 3 Memorial Care Hospitals here in Long Beach, California, as well as the President for the Society of Social Work Leadership in Healthcare. Social workers are often undervalued or sometimes underrecognized, even though they're responsible for the most vulnerable segments of our society. In Long Beach, this means a high population of chronically homeless, and it's the social worker's job to make sure that they're able to stay out of the hospital safely and connect them to the resources that they need in the community. Over the next couple of weeks, we've got some great releases for you with the leadership from Providence in Southern California and also from USC Keck Medical Center. Thank you so much for listening. You can always find us online at our website, pophealthpodcast.com, or on iTunes or Stitcher by searching Pop Health Podcast. You can also find me on Twitter at Pop Health Zach, that's Z-A-C. And as always, thank you so much for listening. I want to thank Scott so much for being here today. Thanks for joining us in our office here.
Yeah, absolutely. It's great to be here.
And I want to thank my co-host, Joe. This is the first time we've gotten to host a podcast together. I really appreciate you coming to join today. Scott, as we jump in here, one of the things that we always like to ask all of our guests, can you tell the audience something that they might not know about you, maybe something outside of work?
Sure. Probably the thing that I spend a large amount of time doing when I'm not thinking about work is playing the violin. So I've been playing since I was about 11, and I would consider myself to be semi-professional, meaning that once in a while I actually get paid to do it,
you know,
which is great. But I play in some community orchestras and every week play in a string quartet, which is really great. Considering the pressures of work, it's a really great outlet.
Do you play in the South Bay?
Not so much, mostly in the Central LA area.
Oh, excellent. Well, that is very interesting. I don't think we've had any quartet or orchestral players yet.
Yeah, that's very interesting, Scott. I actually grew up on classical music. I was self-taught, played the piano since age 3, and I played a little bit of violin in elementary and junior high school.
Oh, cool.
So, yeah. So, Scott, when did you get into social work, and what drove you into the profession?
So, interestingly, actually related to the music question, I was convinced out of high school that I was going to be a professional violin player, and actually started college as a music major, and realized pretty quickly, I would say even within the first couple of months, that that was not in the cards for a number of reasons. And first and foremost of which, I did not at that point in my life have the discipline to spend that much time practicing. So sort of took some time off, and after working for a while, mostly in the arts, and trying to see what I wanted to do next, I kept getting drawn to projects and career thoughts that had to do with helping professions. So not a surprise, my mother is a speech pathologist and worked in public schools and was really committed to obviously helping and helping people to overcome barriers. So it's always been sort of ingrained in me. And I was, I thought that my career was going to be something related to working with teens, mostly probably adolescents in the LGBT community or the coming out process. And so we're talking about the early to mid 90s at this point. And that was still a frontier that was just being crossed, right?
Sure.
Now we have kids coming out when they're even younger than that. So that world has changed completely. As I started to research what that meant for education in terms of what degree I would need, I kept coming back to social work and didn't know a lot about it and did some research and ended up going to complete both of my degrees at UCLA, and I'm a proud 2-time Bruin, and graduated from the School School of Public Affairs, the Department of Social Work in 2001. Interestingly, also during that process, I had no idea going into social work school that social workers worked in hospitals. And it was on a, what I call a field trip, which the university called a module or a field module, that we actually went to UCLA Medical Center and heard from a social worker who worked in the NICU. And it really was one of those lightning bolt experiences. It sounds like such a cliche, but as I sat listening to her talk about the work she did with the families of these patients, really, it became very clear to me in that moment that it was something that I wanted to pursue further. So I ended up doing my second year graduate level internship at Children's Hospital Los Angeles. And those who know me know that the rest is history, because I ended up working there after a quick absence of really about 13 years. Total is how much time I spent at CHLA.
Wow. Now, that's very interesting path. And, you know, social work is such a broad field. For those listeners who may not know, Scott, can you tell us what is the difference between an LCSW and an MSW?
Sure. So really the thing to remember is that the MSW is the graduate degree, right? It's the Master's of Social Work, or if you went to UCLA like me, it's called the Master's of Social Welfare. And pretty much state by state, it varies throughout the country in terms of licensure. But the LCSW is the California State License in Clinical Social Work. So now I'm a little rusty on all of the requirements now because I'm a bit further out of school. But essentially what that means is that a person who's licensed has completed roughly 2.5 to 3 years of supervised clinical experience. I think it's 2,800 hours or 3,200 hours, and then taken two exams in the state of California that would then award that person the LCSW. And so it has enormous implications for social work to an enormous importance for us to get licensed. Not only does it allow us to have a broader scope, so some LCSWs become private practice therapists, or some go work in schools, it just depends on what your interests are. But to be practical and to speak in terms that really speak to other people, you make more money. So it's great. It's really, there is no reason not to be licensed, I always tell anyone that I meet who's considering it.
Excellent. Thank you. Scott, you've spoken in the past about how social work has really changed and evolved as a profession over the years. Can you give some of our listeners an idea of how it has evolved and changed?
Sure. I'm going to speak specifically about social work and healthcare, as I know that that's the sort of the focus of the podcast and also has been the focus of my work. Interestingly, when you look back at the history of social work and hospitals, we have been valued members of healthcare teams really since the early 1900s. So there was a social worker. I think the first social work position was created in a hospital in Boston. And I'll probably get the year wrong, but I think it was 1904 or 1906. And ever since then, the role has expanded. Sometimes it's narrowed, and it's taken on different titles and different shapes as we've gone through the years. The market has gone up and down in terms of the utilization of social work in hospitals and in healthcare organizations. But interestingly, as I think about this question, if you think back about why social workers were invented, I'll say in quotes, for hospitals or placed in hospitals to work, really it was to help medical professionals deal with the social problems that were putting up barriers to patient progress and patient healing. So very similar to what we are doing now. Essentially, that if I have to describe the job of my staff in one sentence, that's it, right?
Right.
What are the barriers that we're addressing to get people out of the hospital and get them back into their homes so that they can heal better? And I don't know another way to say that. Now, of course, things have looked different over the years, as I've said, and the requirements have changed, but really many of the problems have remained the same, right? We went in initially to deal with things like hunger, right? People didn't have food. They didn't have a place to live. They were struggling with mental health issues. So if you look at the top three issues probably that affect our patients even now in 2017 in Southern California, those are often the top three things are basic needs, mental health, homelessness. So sure. Interestingly, that role has remained pretty stable over time.
Sure. And then speaking about the evolution of social work, how has the advancement of case management impacted this specifically?
Well, you've heard me take a breath here before I respond, and only because it some might see that as a bit of a loaded question, and one that sparks strong feelings, I think, on both sides of the spectrum of the emotional scale. Let me just sort of sum it up and say, you know, my history on this might be a little bit rusty, but probably in the 80s, in the 1980s, was when we saw that healthcare organizations started to use a different role, right? So this role started to appear of something called a case manager. Well, case managers have existed for pretty much as long as social work has, right? And it means different things to different people. From a healthcare perspective, and specifically a large hospital perspective, a case manager has become somebody who not only coordinates care, but also many times in many organizations is responsible for utilization management, right? Actually working with payers and making sure that the payer is confident in the fact that the hospital is providing services that are really necessary, right? So that the payer feels that their money is being spent responsibly. Right. So over time, what has happened is that many case management positions have gone to the route of a nursing background, right? So many more case managers have become folks who are trained in nursing. Neither good nor bad, right? It's the skill set lends itself perfectly to that work for nurses.
Right.
Over time, I think there has been some feeling from social work as an industry that, you know, so like sort of like, hey, what happened to us? You know, we were doing this for years. And there was some tension over the years. But I'm actually pretty happy to see now, as of the last few national conferences I've been to and some other organizations that I've become aware of, I think that's really diminishing, at least in my perspective here in Southern California. And I work for an organization that has a really great model that depends on the collaboration of the two disciplines of case management and social work. They are separate. Ironically, some of the case managers are actually social workers who do the work.
Really?
Some are nurses. So I think we've hopefully been able to lose a lot of the, I guess, baggage is the correct term for that, and now really focus on the patients and looking at eradicating, again, those barriers and problems that really trap people in the healthcare cycle, right, of being dependent on us as healthcare organizations.
Right.
I don't know if that answers your question.
Yeah, absolutely. But, well, and just to dive into it a little bit more, so can you just paint a picture? How do the two coexist today?
So I think that how I see it working best are when an organization can build upon the value that both skill sets bring to the operations, right? So what I'm very familiar with, and what I think a lot of the listeners might be familiar with, is a model where the social worker is now operating in a much more traditional psychosocial expert role,
yeah,
right? Involved in things such as full psychosocial assessments that include mental health functioning, basic life needs, what are the family dynamics for that patient that might be making access to care a difficult thing,
sure,
or a challenge.
Sure.
Involved in much more of I use the word clinical in a sort of a psychotherapeutic,
yeah,
perspective. Okay.
Right.
So if the social worker is functioning in that way and the case manager is coming to the table from the perspective of, based on the social worker's assessment often and the physician's assessment and everybody else on the team, what are the systems and structures that need to be put into place for that patient in the community and in the home to make sure that that patient is successful and that individual is successful in conquering whatever health challenge is occurring?
Sure.
A lot of that sometimes for case managers ends up being, sometimes it's a focus on insurance in some organizations. Sometimes,
yeah,
it's more of a focus on really classic care coordination, you know, making sure that there is,
right,
at least one person who is looking at the entire picture of everything that patient's going to need when he or she goes home. You know, the multiple physician appointments that have to happen, the equipment that has to be ordered, the, our basic needs being met.
Yeah.
You know, is there some way to make sure that there's some respite care for the individuals who are caring for that individual? So,
yeah,
things that traditionally have been a social worker's job then sometimes migrated. And so every organization is going to have a different way of dividing that up.
Yeah.
And it's really comes down to people like me and my colleagues in directing these departments to make sure that we're utilizing the clinicians and the experts to the top of their licenses, again, the license word or the skill level, so that the individual is bringing everything to the table and feels really valued.
Yeah. Is the focus on population health changing the roles or changing the way that the two coexist together even?
It's interesting. You know, population health is a concept, right? The name,
right?
The actual term. I keep telling people, and I'm getting louder and louder about this when I'm in gatherings of social workers and case managers and everybody, is that this is the greatest gift ever to be given to social work in the last 10 years, I'll say. Right.
Sure.
Now, it's not new. So again, since social workers have been active in healthcare for over 100 years, our focus is often external, right? Not only are we working directly with a patient on a micro level, right, a one-to-one level, but we always have to be conscious of what's going on in the community that is driving some of the factors that we might be seeing materialize in front of us with this patient. Perfect example of what's going on right now. I'll say Southern California, but specifically, I think we hit this head on every day in the Long Beach area where I work with the issue of homelessness.
Yeah.
Now, ironically, I just went to a conference last week where, and it was sort of a summit by the city of Long Beach with a lot of homeless services providers, where actually we learned that the number of homeless folks in Long Beach has decreased 20% in 2 years.
Wow. Now,
that... It doesn't really gel with what I see every day, right? And I think most people driving around Los Angeles County would say that's impossible because of what we see, right, on freeway underpasses and riverbeds. And I mean, it really feels like it's the worst I've ever
Absolutely.
Seen in my lifetime,
Agreed.
Right?
Yeah.
But here is a subpopulation of people who are utilizing the services of our hospital a great deal.
Yeah.
And obviously, they need medical care. They don't have a lot of places to get it. So coming to a hospital with an emergency department that's 24 hours is a really great place for them to come and get care in their perspective. So if the social worker is not aware, even a hospital social worker is not aware of what's going on in the community, you know, when you start to see an influx of the same problem again and again, you have to be able to put it in some perspective. And so social workers are excellent at being able to look at trending data. And so population health, this whole huge effort now, or healthy communities or whatever we're going to call it, has really been in our wheelhouse for a long time. And so that's why I keep telling social workers, make sure that you're at the table when these things are being talked about. You know, don't depend on someone who maybe doesn't have the background that you do in community analysis and social problem analysis to have that conversation, because somebody's got to be able to represent the human element of this. And sometimes that can get lost when it's a
And I definitely want to dive into the social determinants in a little bit here, but just on kind of a larger scale, you know, with population health, there are a lot of buzzwords that happen. How do social workers directly impact readmission prevention?
First of all, analysis. Okay. I know I've said that a couple of times, but really having a social worker on the team of people that looks at readmission data and the causes of readmission data and really trying to drill down as to what brought that patient back, right? And I don't have any literature sitting in front of me, but we all get the emails every day, right, in our inboxes from organizations that blast us with facts and figures. And most of them are really, really interesting about the psychosocial impact of, you know, what drives readmission, right? So much of it is often has nothing to do with the medical issue that brought the patient in to begin with, right? So someone comes in and has a surgery, even if it's planned, they know months in advance it's going to happen. There can be something that changes in that patient's life when they are home, or something that we didn't think about in the lead up to that. We didn't cover all the bases that will inevitably drive them back to the emergency department,
right?
Or back into the hospital. And a lot of it that I see, again, this is not scholarly academic data. This is my anecdotal information. But so much of it sometimes that I see is just really fear on the part of the patient, right? Or even from the family, that they get the patient home and realize, wait, we were not prepared for what we are facing now that we're home. And then we have to do some cleanup, you know, on the sort of on the readmission part of that. So social workers can't take a backseat to that. We have to be analyzing that readmission data. What are the problems? What are we seeing that for your particular organization are the recurring issues, and go attack it in the community, right? Or go attack it with your community organizations, you know, which is why it's so great to have partnerships with excellent organizations that really help in the community, such as yours, because it's it's so helpful to have the eyes in the home about, right, what's actually going on there.
That's great to hear. I know, Scott, that you represent Long Beach Memorial Medical Center, Miller Children's, and Community Hospital Long Beach. Could you tell us a little bit about those hospitals?
Sure. I've worked for Memorial Care Health System now for, it's going on 2 years already this summer. And essentially, I'm responsible for the operations of the social work services, all of the social work services for three different hospitals. So Long Beach Memorial Medical Center and Miller Children's and Women's Hospital are on the same footprint property. They're in the same block, right? They are separately licensed organizations. And then recently, within the last few months, I've taken on the oversight of the a different thing for me, which is the behavioral health world. So therapists and social workers who staff our mental health unit at Community Hospital Long Beach. So that's a couple of miles away from the Long Beach Memorial campus. And so I'm really privileged to work for an organization that just in where I work employs over 50 social workers. So,
wow.
Yeah, it's really phenomenal to work for an organization that values the discipline so much.
Absolutely. And I know when we were talking a little bit earlier, you were mentioning just the issue of homelessness in the general region where the hospitals are located. Can you tell the audience a little bit about some of the other challenges that your social work teams face at these locations?
Well, it's sort of the classic list of social problems, right? So in addition to homelessness, we really see a split, which I think a lot of hospitals do in this area. You know, we have an extraordinarily diverse patient population. Some who are very well resourced and are able to provide for themselves for meeting a lot of these basic needs. But on the other hand, we serve everyone and we're proud to do so. And so we also see a high number of patients who maybe through one reason or another are unemployed or, you know, chronically unemployed, and so therefore don't have access to healthcare, either health insurance or any kind of regular upkeep, maintenance, as I would say, right? Preventative care. Mental health issues are a huge issue. And probably I would say what my staff spend most of their time on, I think it's fair to say, especially in the emergency setting, is psychiatric intervention. So folks who come in to our emergency department really with no place else to go, who are suffering from a psychiatric emergency and need to be evaluated immediately and connected with the correct resource. So in our community here in Southern California, that is a challenge. The number of mental health beds, as we say, never seems to be high enough to meet the demand, especially in the pediatric world. So, you know, we end up doing some services and piecing together services in a different way, sometimes for patients who don't necessarily meet the perfect criteria to go to inpatient hospitalization. In addition to that, you know, the number of folks who come to us who have a medical need, right? That's only one tiny area of their lives. And I think that that's what sets social work aside as a discipline, really makes us unique, is that we're always looking at what the entire system is for the patient, right? I mean, the mental health issue is really critically important, but what else is happening? You know, it's one element.
Sure.
Sometimes in healthcare, I think, and I've heard a lot of other people from other disciplines say this as well, so I'm okay to say it with confidence that often I think we feel we are the center of patients' lives, right? We are the be-all and end-all of their life. And I think we often have to remind ourselves that, well, that's not really the case, you know, especially if you're talking about pediatrics, right? There are tons of other systems that child encounters. And frankly, I would say the family and school probably are the ones that take up most of their brain power, right?
Sure.
Not thinking about the hospital. So keeping our role in perspective, in terms of what should we be providing, what can we influence, what can we really help them with, but what do we need to draw upon the strength of the other systems to also provide, and social work and case management to a large degree end up being the coordinators of that.
That's definitely a good point, thinking about just the holistic components at the school and the family life and things that can come into play that are taking up a lot more time perhaps than the hospital itself. What does this look like, Scott? What about a story? Is there a specific example or story you could share with us of what these challenges actually look like in real life?
Absolutely. I mean, I keep coming back to when I think of the ones that really hit home, you know, that are really so powerful, usually I end up thinking about our chronically homeless, mentally ill population who, through whatever the reason is, and again, anecdotally, just what we've looked at over the course of my career, it always seems to be that the folks who are suffering the most that I see now from a psychosocial perspective, who are really struggling with mental illness or with an addiction, and who don't ever have stable housing, you know, chronically homeless, you know, that's homeless for more than a year continuously, so often have a history of trauma. So if you look back, you know, you can almost trace it back sometimes to this incidence or this continued incidence when they were young of constant traumatic events and or abuse or violence. And so when you think about that, and what that does to people's functioning later in life, for some people, you know, of course, it is no surprise that it would be impossible for some folks to be able to successfully hold down a job, right? So how it hits me usually is, and how it impacts me on an operational level, because I'm not actually seeing patients, right? I get the pleasure of being the operational oversight,
right?
Is usually I'm finding out that there's somebody who's using our services a lot, right? So this person is in the ED very, very frequently. And so often the question comes up is what is the plan? What are we actually doing for this person rather than just stabilizing them and sending them back out to their problem? Right. So, and I obviously I'm limited on what I can say around individuals, but when I first came to my current position, remember I came from pediatrics. And so my experience and exposure with a homeless mentally ill population was really limited. And so that to me was the crash course coming to that setting. And so learning quickly how to mobilize resources that are not under my control was something that was sometimes a challenge, but ended up being hugely beneficial. You know, I learned a ton about the Department of Mental Health. What are the homeless services doing in Los Angeles County in general? And what does this person really have the capacity to connect with? And sometimes it had to be something that was pretty intensive of actually getting somebody out there to where the person was, not coming to our emergency department when he or she is there, but find that person out in the community and see what life is like and then put together a plan from there.
Yeah. And something that you said earlier struck me about a lot of the same main problems, homelessness, violence, you know, drug abuse, mental health are the same issues that the social work profession has been dealing with. Why is it that we are still dealing with those same questions?
You know, part of the curriculum of social work graduate education is sort of social history, right? So looking at these problems over time, seeing what the course of history was in terms of trying to get at these issues, right? And there were always the pioneers from way, way back. And I always call her the patron saint of social work is Jane Addams, who started the settlement movement, right? Actually trying to get people off the street and into some sort of stable housing. She's who we all sort of hold up, sure, I think, as our idol. But so there have always been those folks, right, who have been the loud voices and the nags, right? You don't get anywhere in solving a problem unless you keep nagging, right? It's that old cliche of the squeaky wheel, right?
Right.
I also don't want to. I know this isn't a political podcast, and I don't want to go into too much talk there. But you really have to look at what's been the political climate over the years. And it's interesting to see, you know, during which administrations in this country things have happened, right? And decisions have been made that continue to have an impact. And I'm just going to say it, I am not smart enough about those issues. I'm not well informed enough about some of the history on that to be able to say, I think it's because of X,
yeah,
right? But it's interesting to me that folks who have been in the discipline for a long time, and by that I mean folks who are my mentors, right, who are now sort of retirement age, really point to the 80s as a pivotal period in the mental health movement, and not in a good way.
Okay.
And so in California, with the deinstitutionalization of, I hate that stain, that word, but the mentally ill, right, the closure of a lot of inpatient facilities, you know, I can remember from graduate school that there were direct correlations with then the number of people who were on the street and sure. the number, the spike in homeless numbers. And, you know, folks who stay homeless for a long time, there are underlying issues that drive that, right? You know,
right.
Really unable to, for some reason or another, engage in a plan
yeah.
to rectify it. And I don't know. I think we need to look back at what decisions we made as a society and as a country, or as even as a state, that have gotten us to that point. And then, so now how do we go back?
Right.
Right. How do we solve it? And that's really what I look to our new
yeah.
young social workers to yeah, take on and figure it out.
Is there a difference between treating the chronically homeless who have the mental health issues because of their service time versus people who maybe had childhood trauma? Is there a big difference in treating those kind of chronically homeless patients?
I philosophically, I don't think there's a difference in treating, right, or engaging them in treatment. I think if we're going to talk about Long Beach, this data happens to be fresh in my mind from this meeting last week. And granted, I'm quoting somebody else's source, so that forgive me if I get some of the numbers. I won't even try the numbers, but I'll tell you a general trend. The homeless count happened in Long Beach in January. And I would highly recommend anybody who's interested in this area of the state or of Southern California, go look at the city of Long Beach's data that they released last week. They're not finished yet. They're still compiling some of it. But in addition to the drop in the homeless, the raw data in terms of the homeless numbers, they've also seen tremendous improvement in the number of veterans who are housed.
Wow.
Right. So the VA is doing something really well. And I think part of my homework over the next couple of months is to find out what that is.
Yeah. You
know, see what are the programs that are in place here at our local VA, because the numbers were pretty staggering in terms of the difference between folks who were housed who were veterans and those who were not. And the yeah. ones who were not seemed to be much higher to
right.
me. So
the one thing that you had mentioned earlier was high utilization of the emergency department, especially by the chronically homeless. I think that this is a problem that we see with our hospital partners a lot, especially, you know, Joe and I being in the senior care and home care industry, where it's difficult for us to take care of people when they don't have a home that they're going to. And it's something that we would love to be able to help out with, but obviously it's a huge challenge. You work in a system that has behavioral health centers, and yet you still see kind of the reactionary use of the emergency department rather than some of the preventative services that are offered by those behavioral health centers. Why is that, first of all? You know, is it just ease of use, or that's just what they're used to? And what are you doing, or how can you work to get those people into the behavioral health centers rather than utilizing the emergency department for every need that they might have?
Yeah, I think we should clarify something about the sort of the high utilizers in emergency departments in general, right? And you've mentioned about behavioral health. Certainly by no means are, you know, not everyone who uses an ED a lot is mentally ill, first
sure.
of all,
sure,
or homeless, for that matter. There could be a variety of reasons that bring them there. And I would say, I mean, I don't know what the percentages are, but the majority of folks that we see are able to be successfully placed in the appropriate, the appropriate type of resource for them. I think just to get to the kernel of the question about what drives people to use mm-hmm. an ED, right, so frequently. I mean, obviously, some of it, if we're talking about homeless, some of it is environmental. So, this past year, Los Angeles had a very rainy season, right?
Yes.
So, which we were all grateful for,
yeah.
right? And then there are the other impacts of
sure.
that, which
sure.
are people need to get off the street,
right?
Right? So, obviously, you know, it's pretty basic from a general basic needs perspective, people need to get out of the weather. And I will speak very highly of our emergency department, that it has a reputation of being a nice place, right? So it's a generally warm, generally pretty accepting environment. And
yeah.
so we, you know, yes, we tend to see some of the same folks who come to us instead of maybe going to a shelter, right? And, you know, we manage those situations because, you know, for the most part, many of them are not struggling with a devastating mental illness, and we're able to manage that. But for a lot of folks who maybe live on the street or don't have access to insurance, don't have access to any regular preventative care, the emergency department is really the only option that they feel they have.
Right.
So
I think that's the operative word too, that they feel right. they have. Yeah. Yeah,
exactly. And so some of it is re-education. Again, not to be overly political, but it seemed to me that when the Affordable Care Act was finally implemented and people were able to get access to some form of health insurance, that it seemed to me that a lot more people were utilizing preventative care services than they had before. And that was just, again, anecdotal information I was hearing from colleagues across the country. There are always going to be still the folks that are not connected to that. And so, you know, they are the ones who are going to show up in the emergency department for things that you and I might not feel are appropriate
right.
for, you know, them to do, you know, cold symptoms, the flu, those kinds of things. Now, need to be treated, right? But we would go to our own doctor for sure. for something like that because we have the resources to do so. So I still fundamentally believe that a lot of this is basic access to assistance
yeah.
and knowing where to find it and knowing how to effectively utilize it.
Sure.
Right. And then also really important that the folks who are in, maybe it's an urgent care center, or maybe it's a clinic, you know, a free clinic. Those folks, I think, are really good at managing treatment plans that work in the community, right? And by that, I mean, we can't just have a cookie cutter way of treating every patient that walks through the door. We have to take into account their environment. What is their access to things like refrigeration, if it's a medication issue? Do they have water? Do they have a place to use a restroom facility? I mean, those kinds of things have to be considered when we're building a treatment plan, or else it will inevitably fail, and then they are back in
yeah.
the emergency department. Sort of like the same thing we see with lack of a good discharge plan for a patient going home from the hospital,
absolutely.
Right? Which you guys see absolutely. All the time.
Yeah. We only have a couple of more minutes here. And again, thank you so much for sitting down with us. You know, we've talked a lot about the mental health part, but this podcast obviously is population health focused. You're the president of the Society for Social Work Leadership in Healthcare. If anybody recognizes Scott from previous podcasts we have actually recorded from the conference that he put on just recently. So that's a nationwide organization, and it represents all different kinds of social workers. First, just really briefly, can you give us an idea? Obviously, I think most people think of social workers within a hospital setting, but you're exposed to all different settings for social workers. What different areas do social workers come from to the society?
It's a great question, and I think one that is always on our minds, those of us who are thinking about the future of the Society for Social Work Leadership in Healthcare. It's a phenomenal organization around for more than 50 years now, and yeah. it, like social work in hospital or in healthcare in general, I fall in the yeah. same trap. like social work in healthcare, has really changed over time. And where it used to be an organization that was specifically created for hospital social work directors, it was really a management and management level
interesting.
Professional organization for supporting them. Over time, as we talked about earlier, with the changes in case management and the changes in hospital finance, there are many, many fewer social work directors in existence now.
Sure.
Right? Some of us are called different things. Some of us went on to different lines of work. Some hospitals went a different direction completely.
Right.
So now our annual conference, which is really our big event every year, and we just had one this past fall in here in Southern California, is really an exciting collection of folks from different walks of
yeah.
life, from professions, as you were getting at. So not only hospitals, which I think are probably still the majority of folks in the organization, but and also let me say that it's about half and half now, divided among our membership between leaders, meaning formal leadership positions,
sure.
and those who are on the front line
sure.
the staff, which is really exciting that yeah. it's made that shift. Right?
Absolutely.
So in addition to hospitals, we see folks from FQHC, you know, mm-hmm. health clinics. We see folks from primary care. There's a growing number of social workers now working in primary care. Hospice continues to be a big employer of social work. Obviously, the VA system. Mm-hmm. The VA system is the largest. It employs more social workers than any other single organization. Not surprising given its size, right?
Right.
But still
right.
committed to the...
And specific challenges, yeah. Makes
right.
sense.
It's pretty phenomenal. Also, you'll see folks from home care, folks from academics also, which is interesting. So professors, those who are teaching around community health or around social work, specifically in healthcare. So it's really an exciting, it's an exciting time. Yeah. And the organization is really, I think, now engaged in some great work thinking about what are we going to be in 5 or 10 years, you know, and how do we continue to be valuable to our profession. And what we hear over and over again is what people want more than anything is the networking and the connection.
Yeah.
So we're trying to think of new ways to.
We talk a lot too on here about, you know, just before we get out of here, we talk a lot about bundled payments and alternative payment models. So that's a little bit different than a lot of the social determinants that we were talking about that hospital social workers face in their frontline day-to-day work. What kind of roles are social workers playing in bundled payments and alternative payment models that maybe is different from their day-to-day work, say, inside of a hospital?
Well, I think it goes hand in hand. Our staff at Long Beach are pretty involved in the day-to-day thinking around how are we making sure people are transitioning safely, right? Which is really the issue,
right?
You know, I mean, of course, how it hits the hospital is the bottom line eventually, right? But I mean, down the road, if we do have readmissions, but really, I'm proud to work for an organization that really thinks about the issue in terms of is the discharge safe, and are we really planning for success and helping this individual patient and the family plan for what's going to work best in their lives with this now hopefully temporary medical situation. Now that can operationalize in a lot of different ways. You know, social workers can be on planning committees around or task forces around how are we treatment planning or how are we planning treatment,
right?
You know, with physicians and nurses. Some of it is going to inevitably be in follow up and, as we say, in cleanup, as I said before, right? So, okay, so we have the readmission. What happened?
Right.
And what I'm really focused on in the next few months is building in a response system to that. I think we're pretty good on the front end of it when we actually have the patient with us the first time. It's when the patient returns that I think we can do some more work around more of a collaborative, you know, approach so that case management and social work go in to see the patient together.
Yeah.
Right. And have that conversation about literally just name the problem. What happened? You know, keep asking the question, why didn't this work out? What about this didn't quite work? You know, what more did you need when you went home now that you see? What could we have done better?
Absolutely.
And being comfortable with that question is, you know, taking it on ourselves. What could we have done better to make this work? And social workers are good at having those conversations.
Yeah.
We're comfortable with being vulnerable in front of a patient. Not a lot of folks are.
Right.
And so I would like to see us utilized more on that front in getting to figuring out where things didn't maybe go so well.
Sure.
You know, and maybe it was an issue on us and maybe things just didn't fly as we thought they would.
I want to, again, thank Scott Ferguson for sitting down with us on Pop Health Podcast. I also want to thank Joe Zimmer for co-hosting with me today. Most of all, I want to thank all of the listeners for joining us yet again. It's always a pleasure to have you, and we look forward to having you again next episode. Thank you.
Pop Health Podcast is a public service of 24-hour home care.